Chapter 3. My stateroom. Ugh. The very thought made me feel unwell. I became their daily guest, as you know. I think that Mrs. Herman from the first looked upon me as a romantic person. I did not, of course, tear my hair coram populo over my loss, and she took it for lordly indifference. Afterwards, I dare say, I did tell them some of my adventures such as they were, and they marveled greatly at the extent of my experience. Herman would translate what he thought the most striking passages, getting up on his legs, and as if delivering a lecture on a phenomenon, he addressed himself, with gestures, to the two women, who would let their sewing sink slowly on their laps. Meantime I sat before a glass of Herman's beer, trying to look modest. Mrs. Herman would glance at me quickly, emit slight ashes. The girl never made a sound. Never. But she too would sometimes raise her pale eyes to look at me in her unseeing gentle way. Her glance was by no means stupid. It beamed out soft and diffuse as the moon beams upon a landscape quite differently from the scrutinizing inspection of the stars. You were drowned in it, and imagined yourself to appear blurred. And yet this same glance, when turned upon Christian Falk, must have been as efficient as the searchlight of a battleship. Falk was the other assiduous visitor on board, but from his behavior he might have been coming to see the quarter-deck capstan. He certainly used to stare at it a good deal, when keeping us company outside the cabin door, with one muscular arm thrown over the back of the chair, and his big shapely legs, in very tight white trousers, extended far out and ending in a pair of black shoes as roomy as punts. On arrival he would shake her man's hand with a mutter, bow to the women, and take up his careless and misanthropic attitude by our side. He departed abruptly, with a jump, going through the performance of grunts, handshakes, bow, as if in a panic. Sometimes, with a sort of discreet and convulsive effort, he approached the women, and exchanged a few low words with them, half a dozen at most. On these occasions her man's usual stare became positively glassy, and Mrs. Herman's kind countenance would color up. The girl herself never turned a hair. Falk was a Dane or perhaps a Norwegian, I can't tell now. At all events he was a Scandinavian of some sort, and a bloated monopolist to boot. It is possible he was unacquainted with the word, but he had a clear perception of the thing itself. His tariff of charges for towing ships in and out was the most brutally inconsiderate document of the sort I had ever seen. He was the commander and owner of the only tugboat on the river, a very trim white craft of 150 tons or more, as elegantly neat as a yacht, with a round wheelhouse rising like a glazed turret high above her sharp bows, and with one slender varnished pole mast forward. I dare say there are yet a few shipmasters afloat who remember Falk and his tug very well. He extracted his pound and a half of flesh from each of us merchant skippers with an inflexible sort of indifference which made him detested and even feared. Schomburg used to remark, "Colin, I won't talk about the fellow. I don't think he has six drinks from year's end to year's end in my place. But my advice is, gentlemen, don't you have anything to do with him, if you can help it." This advice, apart from unavoidable business relations, was easy to follow, because Falk intruded upon no one. It seems absurd to compare a tugboat skipper to a centaur. But he reminded me some, how of an engraving in a little book I had as a boy, which represented centaurs at a stream, and there was one, especially in the foreground, prancing bow and arrows in hand, with regular severe features and an immense curled wavy beard, flowing down his breast. Falk's face reminded me of that centaur. Besides, he was a composite creature. Not a man-horse, it is true, but a man-boat. He lived on board his tug, which was always dashing up and down the river from early morn till dewy eve. In the last rays of the setting sun, you could pick out far away down the reach his beard borne high upon the white structure, foaming upstream to anchor for the night. There was the white-clad man's body, and the rich brown patch of the hair, and nothing below the waist, but the thwart ship white lines of the bridge screens that lead the eye to the sharp white lines of the bows cleaving the muddy water of the river. Separated from his boat to me at least he seemed incomplete. The tug herself without his head and torso on the bridge looked mutilated as it were. But he left her very seldom. All the time I remained in harbor I saw him only twice on shore. On the first occasion it was at my charterer's, where he came in misanthropically, to get paid for towing out a French bark the day before. The second time I could hardly believe my eyes, for I beheld him reclining under his beard in a cane-bottom chair in the billiard room of Schomburg's hotel. It was very funny to see Schomburg ignoring him pointedly. The artificiality of it contrasted strongly with Falk's natural unconcern. The big Alsatian talked loudly with his other customers, going from one little table to the other, and passing Falk's place of repose with his eyes fixed straight ahead. Falk sat there with an untouched glass at his elbow. He must have known by sight, and name every white man in the room, but he never addressed a word to anybody. He acknowledged my presence by a drop of his eyelids, and that was all. Sprawling there in the chair, he would, now and again, draw the palms of both his hands down his face, giving at the same time a slight, almost imperceptibly, shudder. It was a habit he had, and of course I was perfectly familiar with it, since you could not remain an hour in his company without being made to wonder at such a movement breaking some long period of stillness. It was a passionate and inexplicable gesture. He used to make it at all sorts of times, as likely as not after he had been listening to little Lena's chatter about the suffering doll, for instance. The Herman children always besieged him about his legs closely, though, in a gentle way, he shrank from them a little. He seemed, however, to feel a great affection for the whole family, for Herman himself especially. He sought his company. In this case, for instance, he must have been waiting for him, because as soon as he appeared Falk rose hastily, and they went out together. Then Schomburg expounded in my hearing to three or four people his theory that Falk was after Captain Herman's niece, and asserted confidently that nothing would come of it. It was the same last year, when Captain Herman was loading here, he said. Naturally, I did not believe Schomburg, but I own that for a time I observed closely what went on. All I discovered was some impatience on Herman's part. At the sight of Falk, stepping over the gangway, the excellent man would begin to mumble and chew between his teeth something that sounded like German swear words. However, as I've said, I'm not familiar with the language, and Herman's soft, round-eyed countenance remained unchanged. Staring stolidly ahead he greeted him with, "Why Jets, or in English, comma, how are you?" with a throaty enunciation. The girl would look up for an instant and move her lips slightly. Mrs. Herman let her hands rest on her lap to talk volubly to him for a minute or so in her pleasant voice, before she went on with her sewing again. Falk would throw himself into a chair, stretch his big legs, as like as not draw his hands down his face passionately. As to myself, he was not pointedly impertinent. It was rather as though he could not be bothered with such trifles as my existence, and the truth is that being a monopolist he was under no necessity to be amiable. He was sure to get his own extortionate terms out of me for towage, whether he frowned or smiled. As a matter of fact, he did neither. But before many days elapsed he managed to astonish me not a little, and to set Schomburg's tongue clacking more than ever. It came about in this way. There was a shallow bar at the mouth of the river which ought to have been kept down, but the authorities of the state were piously busy gilding afresh the great Buddhist pagoda just then, and I suppose, had no money to spare for dredging operations. I don't know how it may be now, but at the time I speak of that sandbank was a great nuisance to the shipping. One of its consequences was that vessels of a certain draft of water, like Herman's or mine, could not complete their loading in the river. After taking in as much as possible of their cargo, they had to go outside to fill up. The whole procedure was an unmitigated bore. When you thought you had as much on board as your ship could carry safely over the bar, you went and gave notice to your agents. They, in their turn, notified Falk that so-and-so was ready to go out. Then Falk ostensibly when it fitted in with his other work, but, if the truth were known, simply when his arbitrary spirit moved him, after ascertaining carefully in the office that there was enough money to meet his bill, would come along unsympathetically, glaring at you with his yellow eyes from the bridge, and would drag you out disheveled as to rigging, lumbered as to the decks, with unfeeling haste, as if to execution. And he would force you to take the end of his own wire hawser, for the use of which there was of course an extra charge. To your shouted remonstrances against that extortion, this towering trunk with one hand on the engine room telegraph only shook its bearded head above the splash, the racket, and the clouds of smoke in which the tug, backing and filling in the smother of churning paddle wheels, behaved like a ferocious and impatient creature. He had her manned by the cheekiest gang of Lascars I ever did see, whom he allowed to bawl at you insolently, and, once fast, he plucked you out of your berth, as if he did not care what he smashed. 18 miles down the river you had to go behind him, and then 3 more along the coast to where a group of uninhabited rocky islets enclosed a sheltered anchorage. There you would have to lie at single anchor with your naked spars showing, to seaward over these barren fragments of land scattered upon a very intensely blue sea. There was nothing to look at besides, but a bare coast, the mud-dye edge of the brown plain with the sinuosities of the river you had left, traced in dull green, and the great pagoda uprising lonely and massive with shining curves and pinnacles like the gorgeous and stony efflorescence of tropical rocks. You had nothing to do but to wait fretfully for the balance of your cargo, which was sent out of the river with the greatest irregularity. And it was open to you to console yourself with the thought that, after all, this stage of bother meant that your departure from these shores was indeed approaching at last. We both had to go through that stage, Herman and I, and there was a sort of tacit emulation between the ships as to which should be ready first. We kept on neck and neck almost to the finish, when I won the race, by going personally to give notice in the forenoon, whereas Herman, who was very slow in making up his mind to go ashore, did not get to the agent's office till late in the day. They told him there that my ship was first on turn for next morning, and I believe he told them he was in no hurry. It suited him better to go the day after. That evening, on board the Diana, he sat with his plump knees well apart, staring and puffing at the curved mouthpiece of his pipe. Presently he spoke with some impatience to his niece about putting the children to bed. Mrs. Herman, who was talking to Falk, stopped short and looked at her husband uneasily, but the girl got up at once, and drove the children before her into the cabin. In a little while Mrs. Herman had to leave us to quell what, from the sounds inside, must have been a dangerous mutiny. At this Herman grumbled to himself. For half an hour longer Falk left alone with us fidgeted on his chair, sighed lightly, then at last, after drawing his hands down his face, got up, and as if renouncing the hope of making himself understood, he hadn't opened his mouth once, he said in English colon well. ... Good night, Captain Herman. He stopped for a moment before my chair and looked down fixedly, I may even say he glared. And he went so far as to make a deep noise in his throat. There was in all this something so marked that for the first time in our limited intercourse of nods and grunts he excited in me something like interest. But next moment he disappointed me, for he strode away hastily without a nod even. His manner was usually odd, it is true, and I certainly did not pay much attention to it. But that sort of obscure intention, which seemed to lurk in his nonchalance like a wary old carp in a pond, had never before come so near the surface. He had distinctly aroused my expectations. I would have been unable to say what it was I expected, but at all events I did not expect the absurd developments he sprung upon me no later than the break of the very next day. I remember only that there was, on that evening, enough point in his behavior to make me, after he had fled, wonder audibly what he might mean. To this Herman, crossing his legs with a swing and settling himself viciously away from me in his chair, said Colin, "That fellow don't know himself what he means." There might have been some insight in such a remark. I said nothing, and, still averted, he added, "Colin, when I was here last year he was just the same." An eruption of tobacco smoke enveloped his head, as if his temper had exploded like gunpowder. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.